Thanks for tuning into the Far Middle Podcast. It is May. I mentioned this before, my favorite month of the year. One of the most beautiful sounds to me, it's that buzz of lawnmowers and weed whackers on summer and spring weekend days. Okay, maybe we get tired of them after a few hours of their droning on, but you got to admit, when you hear that sound, you know it's time and great time to be outside and to be alive. And despite my allergies to pollen, that's still the case. Look at it this way. It sure as heck beats the sound of a snowplow at 8 a.m. when it's still dark during winter up here in western Pennsylvania. So great time of year. Episode 51, dedication, is going to be a first. And the first is with respect to being a dual dedication. Two people, two individuals will dedicate this episode to. And I selected these two because these two greats epitomize exact opposites in approach to their crafts. So different, so opposite, I had to put them together in a co-dedication, if that makes any sense at all. Now, one was intensely focused, unemotional to the point where almost non-emotional, and definitely a perfectionist. The other one used 100% emotion and attitude to dominate his game. In fact, the only thing I can think of that they both share in common is the uniform number that they wore, which is 51. And I'm talking about Ichiro Suzuki in baseball and Dick Butkus in football. Let's start with Ichiro. Now, his approach to the game and his demands of perfection, they made Tom Brady look like a slacker. Ichiro in Little League in Japan, he had the word concentration written on his glove that he would stare at when he was in the field between pitches. His father, you know, to say that his dad pushed him is a bit of an understatement. His dad told his high school coaches to never praise him so that he would become, the term that he used was spiritually strong. And Ichiro had an unbelievable arm. In fact, he started playing serious baseball as a pitcher, and he would do all kinds of crazy drills to get better and to get stronger. He would try hitting wiffle balls with a giant shovel. He would be throwing these tires, these oversized tires, to get stronger and more focused in his power swing. And he's not a big guy. Ichiro, maybe 5'9", but he is extremely powerful because he wastes nothing. There's no wasted energy in his throwing motion and his swing. Everything that he does is hyper-concentrated, hyper-efficient, hyper-focused. So no movement or kinetic energy goes to waste. Ichiro, he's not so much a freak of nature that you often see with these elite athletes. He's a freak of human self-engineering, would be the best phrase I could think of to come up with to describe him. Now, the experts out there, they said he would never make it in Major League Baseball in the early 90s. And the Mariners gave him Randy Johnson's old uniform number of 51. So Ichiro, he goes out there with the Mariners, and he sets the Major League Baseball record for rookie hits in the season. He broke Lloyd Wehner's record. That's of Pirates fame that stood since 1927. And then he went and led the league in average as well as stolen bases. He was the first one to do that since a guy named Jackie Robinson in the 1940s. And then he went on an MLB tear and career that ended in over 3,000 hits with his career, 10 gold gloves, an MVP, two-time batting champ, the definition of focused. Now you jump over to his partner in dedication for Far Middle Episode 51, but as I said, his opposite in approach, that is Dick Butkus. Now what word would best describe Butkus? How about fierce? I think fierce would be the best word you could come up with. Maybe the most intimidating linebacker in NFL history. I'm thinking of him and Lawrence Taylor. Chicago boy, Illinois captain and star at University of Illinois. A first-round pick by the Bears in 1965. And they had three first-rounders that year. With another one of those first-round picks, they chose a guy that we dedicated episode 40 of the Far Middle to, the great Gale Sayers. And they got that pick, by the way, in a trade with the then laughingstock Pittsburgh Steelers. So sort of a sign of Steelers ineptitude at the time. And Butkus, you know, he was quite big for his day, 6'3", 245, definitely not Ichiro's body type for sure. And I can try to describe how he played, but I think if you took another great and nasty defensive player in that era, maybe a little bit before the late 60s, early 70s in the NFL, Deacon Jones, I think he put it best. Deacon Jones talking about Dick Butkus, quote, "Dick was an animal. I called him a maniac, a stone maniac. He was a well-conditioned animal, and every time he hit you, he tried to put you in the cemetery, not the hospital." I think that sort of sums it up. Butkus did some nice acting, too, on the big screen and TV toward the end of his career and after his career. Loved him in the movie The Longest Yard. And another little piece of Dick Buckus trivia, Rocky, the movie with Sylvester Stallone, of course. Remember in the movie, Rocky had a dog. It was a bull mastiff, and his dog was named Butkus. Who did Stallone name him after? Named him after Dick Buckus. So our first joint dedication in the history of the Far Middle podcast, it's episode 51. It goes to two opposites who shared the number 51, and they shared greatness. They just achieved it in entirely different ways, Ichiro and Butkus. So now that we got our co-dedication out of the way, let's start connecting dots. Let's use how Ichiro and Butkus took widely divergent paths to big-time success, but both employed one main ingredient, good old-fashioned work ethic. It brings to mind a quote, quote, "All growth depends upon activity. There is no development physically or intellectually without effort, and effort means work," end quote. Who said that? President Calvin Coolidge. And we've discussed it many times on the Far Middle that we are losing our work ethic in this nation, that the loss or erosion, what's it coming from? It's coming from policies and practices of government that are specifically intended to dull the work ethic edge of this nation and the people within it. Experts and economists, you know, they're always looking and pointing to things like official unemployment rate, GDP growth or GDP shrinkage, age ratios or demographics. They're looking at all these metrics to assess how our productivity and labor force are sizing up. And all those metrics may have mattered back in the day when we had a true free market economy and a balanced government, whether it's balanced from a fiscal perspective or balanced from a rights perspective. But today, an entirely different nation and frankly, an entirely different world and a different set of situations for sure. Think of all the massive efforts, using that scary term that we brought up in the past, the whole of government, which should make you shiver when you hear that. But think of all the different efforts under whole of government where the state is implemented upon all of us, a way to dumb us down, to take a notch or two off of our drive and motivation, and to penalize, in the end, achievement and to subsidize no work. You can look at entitlements. I think that's maybe one of the biggest examples of this in terms of magnitude. Entitlements get more expansive and less challenging to receive and more financially unstable as time goes on. They become more of a giveaway or a handout to garner votes or to buy votes than to provide a necessary safety net, which is what they originally intended for. And all of those giveaways, you know, they're going to add up. The federal government effectively is bankrupt. We just don't officially recognize it as such. We discussed that in Precipice, the book, and we talked about that when it came to Professor Kotlikoff, who did a lot of the number crunching with respect to the government's fiscal situation, which is quite frightening. And when you do the true accounting and you do the appropriate math of all these off-balance sheet entitlements, so to speak, it is a situation where the government is basically in default or soon to be there. And we don't even recognize it. The design of much of entitlement granting today, it's a process where a problem or a crisis of the moment is used to justify the bureaucracy and the political class buying votes with your money. Millions in these purchases, they turned into billions over the years, and then the billions morphed into hundreds of billions. And now, unbelievably, but it's true, we're talking trillions of dollars. Once established, it's almost impossible to reverse the spending or rein it in. It's a simply unsustainable situation, and we're all going to end up paying that price. Then you saw this also, not just with entitlements, but sort of the COVID pandemic management policies, shutdowns. So these shutdowns, because of COVID, they started right as shuttering everything, all activity. Stores were closed, parks were closed, and of course, work was closed. But then, as time went on, and we learned what pandemic was and what it wasn't, these policies and these shutdowns, they morphed. And what they morphed into, to me, was a very interesting situation. It was one where the stadiums for the sporting events are full or they're open. Beaches and flights for vacations, they're packed more than ever. But everyone is still wanting to work remote. And no one senses that our economy is ever going to go back to the traditional 40-hour in-person work week. That's the work arrangement that built the world and made this nation the greatest ever, by the way. So if that goes away, it makes you start to wonder and to question, how long will our strengthened position or strategic standing hold up? And then beyond entitlements and beyond what you saw with COVID and pandemic, shutdown policies, how those things have eroded work. You also see what's going on with higher education. Higher education continues to breach its fiduciary promises to educate students for a reasonable rate of tuition with skills and degrees that are in demand in the workplace. That simply isn't happening anymore. And government enables all this because they create a massive forced subsidization of college. Some of that subsidization is direct, some of it is indirect. We talked about that in many instances in the past on the Farm Middle. But students and families and taxpayers were all getting fleeced as tuition bubbles go way up. Students are graduating with less skills because more and more of their credit hours are being diluted and consumed with ideology indoctrination instead of developing hard skills. And the job market doesn't pay for these degrees and skills with wages that are anything close to what would cover tuition debt payments, let alone a decent rate of return. So you look at Ichiro, you look at Butkus, they are what humans strive to be, whether it's in athletics, literature, music, business, you name the endeavor. Everybody wants to achieve, everybody wants to strive to be great. That's just an individual drive that is innate in all of us. And to erode the pathways to achieve with the opiate that are government policies, whether it's entitlements or pandemic policies, or what's going on with subsidization and not holding higher education accountable, that opiate of policies and the whole of government is basically diverting, washing away the path to greatness, the path to achievement, for who knows how many of us out there, and that should warrant some serious thought and consideration. If you think my view on this is a bit dramatic or overstated, considering how this very thing is demoralizing our best and brightest at younger and younger ages, I read an article recently about how the students that are working the hardest and performing the best in high school, they're being denied shots at the best colleges in the post-COVID world of elite academia. And the first thing that struck me on this article was the title. The title was, "For Top Students, Rejections Pile Up." Huh? I read that and I had to read on, which was probably why the news entity that I'm talking about, the editor for it, wrote the title that way. Classic bait and hook, nice job. It got me not just to read it, but now to talk about it in a podcast. The focus of the article itself was on a young lady in high school applying to college. I would not describe her as your typical student or college candidate. She started algebra in the third grade. It's a little bit before I did. And SATs, I think she did pretty well. She scored a 1550, which is a near perfect score. 3.95 GPA unweighted. Directed 30 plays, 3-0. Has a part-time job. Founded the high school accounting club. Took 11 AP courses. Was in the choir. Ran a summer camp. Now, she was described, I believe, by one of her teachers or guidance counselors as extraordinary. I think that is very apt in this case. I agree. So she goes out and she applies to numerous colleges and universities. So what were the results of these applications? Stanford, rejection. Harvard, no. Yale, sorry. Brown, rejection. Cornell, no. Penn, sorry. Southern Cal, rejection. Berkeley, no. Northwestern, sorry about that, can't take you. All of them basically rejected her application. Rice waitlisted her. Texas said yes, but there was a but to it. They would accept her, but they would not accept her into their business school, which is what she wanted to study and major in. Why such a massively and cumulatively negative outcome for an extraordinary student like this? Well, it's because of a couple of reasons. And they go back to this topic that we were speaking of when it comes to work ethic and whole of government and how academia is in the middle of a lot of this as well. First, most of these schools ended up dropping entrance exam requirements like the SAT. So applications and applicants, they exploded across the board. And the schools love that because it helped these elite schools bloat their application stats, which a lot of them used to market their sort of exclusivity and desirability. And it also helped really lower the selective acceptance rate. If you got double or triple applicants coming in and you're still taking basically the same number of students, then your acceptance rate plummets. That makes you look more exclusive as well. And that also means when you just do the math of volume of applications that admissions officers at these elite schools, they are looking at an applicant like this student in the story for maybe 10 seconds. There is no way that the admissions officers are investing the needed time to review the application to get a legitimate feel for what each student brings to the table. It's become a sham. It's become basically a bit of theater. And the young lady, here's another problem that she ran into. The young lady obviously is female, and elite academia, they obsess, of course, about hitting targets with respect to all kinds of different demographics, sometimes ethnic, sometimes gender, to the point where there are more female college students than male. And being female actually hurts admission chances, which is crazy. That makes no sense when you're looking at things like diversity and inclusion, but there you go. Another thing that was working against her, she's middle class. And you do not want to be middle class when you're going through the college admission game. That's between a rock and a hard place. So if you are from underserved communities, academia will try to compensate in the admissions process and target students from those demographics. Sometimes it'll be ethnic, sometimes economic, or sometimes both, which is laudable. That's great. If only the public education system before college would do a better job of preparing these students from underserved communities for college and life skills. That's where the problem is. They're ill-prepared going in because the system is basically broken. If you're on the other side of the socioeconomic spectrum, if you're rich or connected or both, you've got a great chance to get into whatever school you want. And just look at the most elite of the elite, which is Harvard. Half of white students admitted from 2009 to 2014 at Harvard were either athletes, legacies, which means their parents or grandparents went to Harvard, kids of faculty and staff at Harvard, or their parents were donors. So you can buy or know your way into the best of the best when it comes to colleges. You can donate a cool $1 million to Harvard and your kid gets in. And how that's all that much different from the college admission scandal where rich parents were going through a college coach to pay off their way into programs for their kids, I'm not sure. Certainly there are some nuanced differences here, but boy, it sure feels about the same in terms of the essence of it. Now, the situation that's going on with who's getting accepted to elite institutions of academia and how some of our best and brightest are failing to do so, it's also helping to grow that trend that I think we talked about a ways back in the far middle about the gap year. The gap year, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's when a young adult coming out of high school before they go into college, or even when exiting college before they enter the workforce, they basically take a year off. And oftentimes the year that is taken off is because the job prospects aren't what they were hoping for coming out of university, or the acceptance opportunities weren't what they were hoping for in the case of our student in the story that we just discussed, coming out of high school to go into college to start the next chapter. Gap years were already growing tremendously in the nation, and now they're at an all-time high. And the biggest single root cause or factor that's pointed to with the growth rate being what it is in gap years is this low acceptance rate or ratios that we're seeing across elite universities and academic institutions. So it's another consequence that's occurring when the whole of government gets focused on things like work ethic and meritocracy and how it impacts our youngest and best and brightest members of the workforce. So students like the young lady in the article, they get the short end of the stick, which is really an unfortunate as well as an absurd outcome if you think that the best should be getting the opportunity. Those that work the hardest, it's what you'd call a meritocracy. And in a free enterprise, individual rights-based society like the one that we supposedly have, that's exactly the type of thing you'd want to see. Instead, we've got another blow to the foundation of the American work ethic. And as I said, it hits the best and brightest at a very impressionable young age. Welcome to what happens when the left runs things across academia. And I suppose we should all be getting used to it. Now, the vice provost for enrollment at Cornell in this story, this article, had a quote that illustrates just the absurdity bordering on arrogance of the bureaucracy that you see at elite academic institutions. The quote was, "We know that most of those we couldn't admit would have been capable of achieving excellence at Cornell, and we regret having to disappoint them." Ugh, please. Now let's jump to the next dot, shift some gears, but still stay on this theme of whole of government, government policies cumulatively, how they change a lot of things that impact each and every person out there. So I want to shift to a night that I had out on the town recently in downtown Pittsburgh, my hometown. And we went to go have dinner and then see a play. The play was Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express. I am a big fan and reader of Agatha Christie since I was a kid. I love Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple. That's classic stuff. Well, this Saturday evening, it was a great weather night in western Pennsylvania. And we went for pizza and a beer for dinner beforehand, hung out, the wife and I, and then we went to the Agatha Christie play. And maybe that's the definition of exciting and fun for me, as lame as that might sound, but there you have it. I did, however, through that evening, have a string of observations about the state of our great cities coming off of that night in the Steel City. And not a lot of it's good. Some of it's troubling, I'm sorry to say. And I wanted to share some of those observations with you. The first observation was painfully obvious to me. City planners these days are doing everything they can to make it as stressful as possible to drive a car in downtown areas. Pittsburgh is no different. You drive off the bridge into the Golden Triangle of downtown Pittsburgh, and the pain, it just starts immediately. So the first thing you're encountering are buses, even on a Saturday evening. And a lot of them are those double buses that are two sort of bus carriages back to back. They're everywhere, clogging up the intersections. And what's really ironic about all this is almost all of them are not even half full. Many of them, they might have one or two people on them. It's Saturday night, not, you know, the morning rush of a work day during the work week. Why are we running all these buses with basically nobody on them? Then all those buses, they're driving in bus-only lanes, which means we took away a lane for cars and private vehicles, making congestion and wait times way worse. So traffic congestion gets worse as public transportation expands, at least the way American cities do public transportation and scheduling and logistics for it. And then there are the lanes that aren't for any motorized vehicle. These are the bike lanes, you know, the lanes that represent sustainable nirvana for urban planners. Pittsburgh, you know, it's cold, non-biker friendly weather half the year. It's raining half of the remaining half of the year. Why do we need to take away traffic lanes in downtown areas used all year long every day by millions to create an exclusive zone for a few people only some of the time? It's ridiculous when you look at it rationally. And I have yet to run into anyone who said that they decided to start riding bikes everywhere instead of driving because of a bike lane. But you know, maybe I'm just missing those individuals. So now you take what was a four-lane major artery downtown, you subtract a bus lane, or maybe two if there's one in each direction, and then you subtract a bike lane. You now have a main artery designed for four lanes that are cut down to two or less, meaning one way, which is going to spell perpetual traffic congestion. But wait, our city planners have much more to offer to frustrated drivers, much more. You see, Pittsburgh's noted for construction that starts but never ends. So in strategic intersections downtown, you're going to run into closed off roads, blocked turns, shut down lights, which takes this bad situation and rolls it into the disaster category. So I finally get to a parking garage near the Cultural District Theater and the restaurant, which is in downtown. And I'm ready to pull in, but wait, the garage is full. Well, actually, it's not full, but it won't take any more cars because this garage has now reserved almost an entire level of the parking facility for public works vehicles from the Public Transportation Authority. And it also set aside all these spaces for electric vehicles. So if you don't have a lease, no go, you're not parking there on that Saturday evening, which means back into the massive cars in a traffic jam to look for another garage. Basically, all the cars around me were looking for the same thing. Bottom line, we had a 5:30 p.m. dinner reservation. We came off the bridge and entered downtown at 4:45. The restaurant was a quarter of a mile away. With the traffic, the construction, and the full garages, I arrived at the restaurant at 6:05, almost an hour and a half to get to the garage and park the car. Huge time waste, not a good start to the evening. Then comes the second observation. On my not-so-short walk from the garage, I finally was able to park to, in going to the restaurant, and thankfully, I was able to drop the wife off closer to the restaurant and meet her there. I walked past probably a dozen or so restaurants, and I saw one of two things. One was a shuttered and closed establishment that was never coming back, and I assumed those were casualties of the pandemic shutdown policies that the city and the state imposed on all of us. And then the second thing I saw were open establishments that were basically overwhelmed, packed to the gills. So I walked past a dozen of these restaurants and, you know, a score of them were basically shuttered and looks like they weren't coming back. And the other ones that were open were just packed full. And government policy basically killed half the restaurants and then created restaurant scarcity where the wait lists are long and staff is stressed at the remaining restaurants. I thought that was an interesting observation. So I get to the restaurant, it's packed, but we've got reservations and a table, grab a beer, look at the menu, see that it's a bit of a short menu, much shorter than the last time I was there, which was before pandemic. It had been a while. The waiter tells us that they cut back on the menu because of inflation and lack of available foodstuffs and the ingredients, and because of a short-staffed kitchen. So here we go again, back to those themes of what we're doing to work ethic and stoking inflation and creating scarcity all through government policies from the local to the national. Now, in the interest of time and to keep the suspense, since we're talking Agatha Christie in full mode for the Far Middle podcast, I'm going to save a couple of additional observations for episode 52, which is another milestone episode, 52 weeks, 1 year anniversary next week. But I'll get to those in the following week, as I said. I do want to spend and wrap today's episode of the Far Middle to talk a little bit about the play itself. Again, it's Agatha Christie, and in my book, there is no such thing as bad Agatha Christie. Been reading her since I was, as I said, a kid. I like the books. I like the old movies. I like the new movies. I like the TV versions. I like all the plays. So let me give you a few tidbits about the great Agatha Christie, because I think as time has gone on, people today have lost appreciation for just how successful and what level of excellence she achieved in her career. She wrote the world's longest running play. That's The Mousetrap. It's been playing in London since the early 1950s. She sold a few books in her time, a few more books than I sold with Precipice, I'm sorry to say. She sold 2 billion books, in fact. Agatha Christie is the best-selling fiction writer of all time. And Then There Were None, which is one of her more famous titles, sold 100 million copies by itself. She's the most translated writer of all time. And in the 1920s, she became the subject of intrigue and a bit of controversy. She was having some marital issues with her husband at the time, and he wanted a divorce. And after a fight they had, she basically disappeared. And again, she was a celebrity at the time, so she just vanished. And all they found was her abandoned car. So it became an international story. Her disappearance was front page news in the New York Times. Over 1,000 police were looking for her in the UK. There were something like 15,000 volunteers that were engaged in the search. Arthur Conan Doyle, of course, who created Sherlock Holmes, he held a seance to try to help find her. I mean, this became a massively huge international story. What happened to Agatha Christie? Where did she go? Well, she turned up after about 10 days at a hotel/spa that was far away from her home. And she registered under an alias, and the alias that she used was the also using the last name of her husband's mistress. She said or claimed that she had amnesia. I'm not sure many people believe that, but that was her story. Now, she eventually ended up getting divorced but found love again. She remarried, and she remained so until her death in the mid-70s, 1976. So I assume all's well that ends well. And that ends episode 51 of The Far Middle. Until next week, stay as disciplined as Ichiro, as fierce as Butkus, and as prolific as Christie.